In this episode of the Groundings Podcast, I interview Derek Ford, an organizer and educator who gives a historical background for the current imperialist aggression surrounding the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea. He covers the Juche ideology, and he recounts some of his firsthand experiences, which shattered a lot of Western propaganda and myth surrounding the country while he was traveling there. Derek Ford is an organizer, academic, and educational theorist. He is an organizer with the Answer Coalition and Korea Peace Tours, co-editor of LiberationSchool.org, and an assistant professor of education studies at DePaul University. His research examines the educational logics at work in political systems and how educational theory can help us reimagine and reenact our ways of being together. He has written and edited 6 books, including Communist Study, Education for the Commons. Without further ado, here is episode 2 of the Groundings Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me so much, Devin.
Yeah, of course. So you first traveled to North Korea, aka the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, last summer, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, we went in early August.
And so with you going, you know, as someone who is on the left and an organizer and well-studied, did you still have some sort of preconceived notions or still have some thin layer of propaganda that you arrived there with?
Yeah, I would say definitely, because, you know, as critical as I am of the media, the only information that I have about the country and the people and the history, you know, is still filtered through others. And, you know, it's hard to sort of, you know, you, I guess that you, so you have certain, you know, spots that you, you know, maybe haven't, one hasn't examined. And so there were definitely some things that I was still somewhat surprised at. And I'll say, you know, one example is I was incredibly surprised at how objective the official tour guides were. So I went with 4 other people. We were all traveling on U.S. passports, although one, my friend who has been to the DPRK hundreds of times, is was actually born in South Korea, although he's not allowed back in South Korea at this moment in time. And he's had several sort of, you know, he's been exiled previously from South Korea because of his peace work. So we were shown around the country through a media organization that's called Dawn Media, which is a new group in the country, and it's an independent media group, which means that it's independent of any political parties, including the Workers' Party of Korea. It's independent of the state apparatus also. And so we had a lot of access, and we had arranged talks with scholars and with farmers and with students and with scientists and with workers and with soldiers that were, you know, fairly informal. But we also, of course, went on tours. And I was surprised at the level of objectivity that the tour guides and some of the escorts had. And so I'll give you an example. Well, something that I heard multiple times from the soldier who escorted us to the demilitarized zone, where the talks between the North and South were happening earlier this week, in early January. And he said, you know, of course, this is also where the talks were held during the Korean War between the DPRK and the U.S. forces. Mm-hmm. And right. So he said, as we were getting down, as we were, you know, approaching, he said to us, so there was a museum aspect to it, you know, pretty much. And he said, what we're going to show you is what happened according to our perspective. And we just want you to just try to put yourself in our shoes and try to understand where we're coming from. And at the Sinchon Museum of U.S. War Crimes, the tour guide said to us, "This we're going to tell you the history of the war from our perspective. And we ask that you just take this into account. And then we want you to make up your own mind." And I was you know, even scholars like Bruce Cummings, who are fairly critical, you know, are very critical of the U.S., definitely aren't pro-DPRK in any way. But, I mean, if you read his work, you get the impression that these are all just, like, sort of ridiculous, over-the-top propaganda tours where people say, like, the DPRK has never done anything wrong and we're only ever the victims and, you know, look at all these atrocities and these sort of overblown narratives. But that actually wasn't the case at all, well, including...
Sorry, yeah, I don't mean to interrupt, but I think that, that kind of propaganda narrative goes much deeper than just scholars and scholarship and writers as well. I mean, one of the most controversial but most popular movies a few years ago starred James Franco and Seth Rogen, where the entire premise was that they've been to North Korea and they were shown fake restaurants and fake religious spots and fake towns. The whole premise of the movie was that it was just a fake tour that they were taken on that made them fall in love with North Korea and want to live and stay there. But I definitely think that, you know, in the media, I've even seen CNN, MSNBC commentators talking about how when Dennis Rodman went there, he was only shown, quote, one side of the country, right? So yeah. this kind of narrative is definitely very huge and very, very deeply ingrained.
Yeah, and it serves to, like, ultimately discount ahead of time anyone's actual experiences there, right? People will say, like, if you say something positive about North Korea or even, like, defend it in any way, like, well, you know, how would you know you'd never been there? And you could say, well, actually, I have been there. And they'll say, like, yeah, but you didn't really see everything. And, you know, I'll give you other examples of how that's not true is we obviously spent a lot of time in Pyongyang. It's the capital. It's highly, highly developed. But we went to other cities and we went to the countryside. We went to other towns in the countryside. And so we saw, you know, like five-star hotels or, you know, what would be the equivalent of a five-star hotel in the U.S. But we also saw people who were living in, you know, sort of like makeshift housing in the countryside. And we saw, you know, also sort of dilapidated housing. And the Koreans were very proud to show us everything. And they were really proud of the latest sort of scientific technologies and a new science research center in Pyongyang. But they were just as proud to show us the sort of, you know, the farmers' housing in Sariwon. And I think that this is, I think that this helps sort of illuminate the, you know, what is known as the Juche ideology, the Juche philosophy, or Juche thought, which has a sort of, you know, I mean, interesting history. I think that it's, you know, it's pretty much the one thing people in the media especially are always saying, like, oh, we don't know anything about the DPRK and it's, you know, so irrational or whatever. But I mean, actually, it's really their behavior is, and by their, I mean, the government's behavior is, you know, it's incredibly consistent over time. And it's actually not unpredictable at all. And it's based in a particular kind of rationality.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that along with the government's actions and rationality being extremely consistent, it's also very transparent. There is an official DPRK website that puts out news briefs daily, updates information, has, you know, a gallery, information about tourism, has an e-library for reading and educational materials about their country. And there's an entire page that explains the Juche ideology. So along with it being predictable, it's also fairly transparent, especially compared to other countries where I think we sometimes know a lot less about the U.S. government or Western governments than places like this that pretty much have it very transparently open on the internet.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you look at the Trump administration, like even people in the Trump administration can't anticipate what the government's going to do tomorrow. yeah, and that's like exactly the opposite in the DPRK. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think another point, you know, it seems, would you say that there's a double standard that takes place? Because I know that when tourists come to New York City, for example, or they come to the West Coast and they go to LA and Hollywood, they tend to only navigate to or gravitate to the parts of the city that are attracted to tourists, that are well, quote unquote, developed, that have five-star hotels and large theaters and arenas. And I mean, I don't know any tourists who come to the U.S. and who actively seek out impoverished areas or areas where there's been decades of, you know, structural racism that now has it looking terrible and demolished and, you know, all these various things. So I think that the interesting part of what you just described is really the double standard narrative. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, like, there's places in the U.S. where you can't visit, right? I mean, you know, it's not like they take you on tours of Guantanamo Bay, right? Or military installations or something like that. And, you know, the other thing I always emphasize is that, so I'm coming from the United States, a country which, you know, destroyed Korea between 1950 and 1953, carpet bombed it for multiple years, and which is still threatening to annihilate it with nuclear weapons. And so it's like totally understandable for North Korea to then restrict my movements or my entry into their country in any way, right? Like, where does this idea come from that, like, I should just have unfettered access to go anywhere in the world and, you know, sort of be able to go anywhere that I want? When this is like, I think that we should respect North Korea's sovereignty. There's excellent reasons for them to, you know, tourism is incredibly destructive. It's an incredibly destructive industry. And it's really ravaged many countries, many cities, and it's also sort of a safeguard against that kind of, you know, chauvinistic destruction that so many, especially American tourists and white tourists visit upon oppressed nations and formerly colonized nations.
Definitely. I think tourism is an extremely colonial structure. Yeah, I'm from the Caribbean islands, so tourism generates a lot of money, but never actually for the pockets of the people who it is largely impacting. So another point you made was the U.S. war aggressions against Korea. And I think that the number is somewhere around 630,000 tons of explosives that were dropped on North Korea during the war. So this notion of objectivity that you mentioned earlier becomes even more, I don't want to say fascinating, I guess within that context, remarkable. Because to me, it would be justified if there wasn't objectivity and it was more so a subjective appeal to emotion, having previously had your entire country carpet bombed by 630 tons of explosives. So you mentioned briefly the Juche ideology. And now if I'm ever pronouncing that wrong, please correct me. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what you saw firsthand, as well as your understanding of the ideology?
So the Juche is dominantly translated as self-reliance or independence, but I think a more accurate and comprehensive translation is subjecthood. And by subjecthood is meant sort of the ability, you know, the being of a subject and being in an active, what, you know, is referred to, for example, as a subject of history. It means forces that make history. So if you were to say, for example, that the working class is a subject of history, then that means that it's the working class, right, which advances history. And so by subjecthood, it's meant, that's precisely what it's meant. It's meant that one, in this case, the sort of Korean people are the makers of Korean history. It's born under particular circumstances, right, really unique historical circumstances, and it comes out of, just as the sort of roots of North Korea are located in the struggle against Japanese imperialism, this is also where the Juche idea comes from. So, you know, Korea was an independent, unified nation, one history, one people, right? Common language, culture, traditions, customs, economy for thousands of years. And there were several attempts to colonize Korea, right? Because Korea sits in between Japan and China. And Japan colonized Korea, launched an offensive in really 1890, and formally colonized Korea in 1910, and subjected the continent to, you know, brutal colonialism. I mean, colonialism is a brutal regime. So there was slavery. They kidnapped people and brought the Koreans and brought them to Japan. Many of those Koreans actually still live in Japan. They're waiting until Korea is united to return home. So there was, of course, resistance. And Kim Il-sung, who's credited as the founder of the DPRK, was a, you know, particularly important resistance fighter. He joined the communist resistance at, he was still in high school. He was expelled from high school for organizing walkouts. And the North Koreans locate the origins of Juche in a speech that Kim Il-sung gave at a June 1930 meeting of the Young Communist League and the Anti-Imperialist Youth League in Jilin Province in China. And the Anti-Imperialist Youth League is an organization that Kim Il-sung had founded. At this time, he would have been, of course, a quite young man. But the sort of it doesn't get articulated really until 1955. And several things happen between 1930 and 1955. Many Korean communists, there actually wasn't a Korean Communist Party during the 1930s. It was disbanded by the Comintern, and Kim Il-sung wasn't actually affiliated with that particular formation. And sort of under the direction of the Comintern, the Korean communists were asked to join the Chinese Communist Party because they were fighting together in Manchuria. This was at the behest of the Soviets, and so it's estimated that when the merging process was consolidated in 1931, as much as 90% of the Chinese Communist Party was actually Korean, because their efforts at recruitment, the Koreans' efforts at recruitment among the peasants in Manchuria had been much more successful than their Chinese counterparts. You know, so the Koreans who had been, you know, struggling, I mean, they had a common enemy, and so they, you know, they identified with the Chinese communists, and they said, yes, you know, we'll be absorbed into your organization, right? Because we have this common enemy. And in February of 1932, which is 5 months after Japan successfully invaded Manchuria, there were these pro-Japanese Koreans, which organized a group called the Minsongden, which stood for People's Livelihood Corps. And basically, they were trying to agitate for an autonomous Korean region in Manchuria. And it was, you know, basically trying to appeal to the Japanese. And they thought, the Minsongden thought that, like, it'll be a great way to divide the Korean people from the Chinese people, and so you won't have to worry about our resistance. But Japan actually didn't really endorse it. They didn't want ethnic strife or national divisions. And so the organization was dissolved within a year, right? It was active for like 6 months or whatever. And the Korean and the Chinese communists obviously strongly opposed this organization, and they killed several of their members while they were active. But after they disbanded, they rightly worried that elements of the group would infiltrate the guerrilla resistance. And so the East Manchurian branch of the Chinese Communist Party, they launched a series of purges against Japanese collaborators within their ranks. And it's generally agreed that there were indeed sort of infiltrators. And the Korean communists were enthusiastic initiators of the purges, but they quickly degenerated into basically an anti-Korean purge. Between 1932 and 1935, at least 1,000 Korean communists were killed by their Chinese comrades. And the highest estimates are about 2,000 to 2,500. And Kim Il-sung actually was almost killed. He narrowly escaped, in part because of his sort of fierce commitment to Korean independence, right? He was suspected of being a spy. Right. This was in 1934. But he had, at this time, he had a reputation as a key guerrilla leader, and he actually organized and led the first operation of Chinese communists and nationalists, and saved a nationalist life during this sort of attack. So several leaders intervened, and what they did was they sent Kim north on a three-month-long expedition. And during those 3 months, the Chinese Communist Party was able to sort of intervene and not stop the purges, but sort of put them on hold. And so when Kim returned, he helped really put an end to the purges, which were officially suspended in 1936. You know, the relationship was strained, but with the help of the Comintern, they repaired the United Front. And of course, the Koreans who got state power in 1945 would return to Manchuria in 1949 to provide decisive assistance to the Chinese Revolution. And there's no doubt that the entry of so many Korean fighters who had been steeled in guerrilla struggle were really, mm-hmm. you know, really decisive in that victory. But it's an important origin in the formation of Juche, right? Because the Korean communists joined the CCP, and then they were betrayed by their Chinese comrades. And so they, you know, reasonably believed that the Korean liberation struggle had been subordinated to or even sacrificed to the larger, more powerful forces, right? And mm-hmm. and this would include the Soviet Union. Although it was two junior U.S. officers, Dean Rusk and Charles Bonesteel, who in 1945 took a map of Korea, located the 38th parallel, which would allow the U.S. to get Seoul, the capital, but still divide it roughly in half. That was an act of national chauvinism by the U.S., but it could also be reasonably understood as an act of national chauvinism by the Soviet Union, which went along with it, right? I mean, obviously, there's a reason that they went along with it, which is that they had just, you know, sacrificed so much destroying the Nazis, 27 million people, that, you know, they weren't about to start, you know, they weren't looking to start another war. And it wasn't, you know, the real power after 1945 in the North was actually these people's committees that had spontaneously sprung up and were, of course, you know, the result. Nothing's ever really 100% spontaneous. They were a result of communist organizing for decades. But it wasn't like a puppet government or anything like that. But what happens is North Korea shares a border with China and with the Soviet Union. And it has Japan on one side, and it has the U.S. troops to the south of it, because the U.S. troops enter South Korea in 1945 and are still there to this day. The Soviet troops left in 1948 and have never returned. No foreign troops have ever since, you know, occupied North Korea. And so basically, in the 1950s, the two incredibly large socialist forces on their border. And relations between those two large socialist countries were deteriorating during the 1950s.
I mean, and just to contextualize this a little bit on a larger, more global perspective, at this time, we're up into pretty much the late 40s, beginning of what's about to be the 50s, and we have decolonial movements that are pretty much being waged all across the world right now, particularly across several African nations and a few Caribbean islands as well. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just wanted to situate that in a larger context, that this is congruent with and in conversation with larger decolonial struggles that are happening, as well as borderline socialist and socialist uprisings as well, taking place in areas such as Ghana or Cuba and these other places, or at least the beginning workings of this. So then Korea finds itself situated in what is turning into a split and a deteriorating relationship between the two large socialist superpowers, basically.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, you know, basically when Stalin died in 1952, right, there was an internal struggle in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. What sort of, you know, and there was a lot of instability. And this is when there were several anti-Soviet revolts that were attempted. For example, there was a attempted counter-revolution in Hungary, another one in Poland. They were trying to sort of seize this, you know, this instability. So Khrushchev emerges as the leader in 1955, 1956. He's the first secretary of the Communist Party of Soviet Union at this point. And he begins to articulate a theory of peaceful coexistence, right, which is sort of the idea that the Soviet Union and the U.S. can peacefully coexist, and it's an olive branch to the U.S. But the People's Republic of China had just, you know, had their revolutionary victory. The Soviet Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, was in 1917, and so it was already, you know, sort of a new generation was emerging that wasn't necessarily steeled in the revolutionary struggle. But in China, you know, there was still a, you know, very real revolutionary ethos. And so there were a series of debates over particular policies and criticisms of particular policies that went back and forth between China and the Soviet Union. And of course, you know, that's all well and good, but this degenerated into a state-to-state conflict, and the Chinese end up characterizing the Soviet Union, you know, critiquing not just its policies, but its actual social system, and saying that capitalism was restored and that the Soviet Union was social imperialist. And the struggle between them was so intense that in 1960, the Khrushchev leadership recalled all Soviet technicians from China who were, you know, playing a critical role in the economic development projects and modernizing the country. So, it was really serious. And within the Workers' Party of Korea, which emerges in 1948 through the coalescing of sort of a couple of different communist groups with Kim Il-sung as a leadership, there were pro-Soviet and pro-Chinese groupings. And so there were really important questions like, where would the party stand on the ideological struggle between the two forces? What country would they develop economic ties with to rebuild the country? So the state was literally and politically caught in the middle of this fight. And the Soviet leadership insisted on conformity with its political orientation. And the Soviets, you know, they wanted to diminish tensions with the U.S. And ultimately, right, North Koreans needed assistance and cooperation from both the USSR and the People's Republic of China. But they didn't want to be dictated to by either of these socialist giants, right, in sort of quid pro quo arrangement for aid and for trade. And the situation came to a head in 1956. In February of that year, Khrushchev made his secret speech at the 20th Congress, where he repudiated Stalin and his legacy. In April, the USSR sent a delegation to the Workers' Party of Korea's Third Party Congress, and Brezhnev was the delegate. And in his address to the Congress, he agitated against a cult of personality issues in the DPRK, which was clearly an attack on Kim Il-sung. And Kim Il-sung was sent to the USSR over the summer, during which time the pro-Soviet faction of the party and the pro-Chinese faction, which was called the Yonan faction, they conspired to depose Kim at an upcoming plenary session of the Central Committee. And it wasn't just sort of an intra-party struggle, right? So, for example, on August 1st of that year, the official newspaper of the party Central Committee ran a column endorsing all Soviet criticisms of the Stalin era, including the cult of personality. But what happened was, when the plenary happened, you know, both factions were shouted down by the rest of the Central Committee. Because, you know, many, they were looking to the USSR and China, not just for economic support, but also for things like culture. I mean, they were arguing that Korean culture was backwards, and so they had to embrace Soviet dressing styles, right, or Chinese artistic styles. And because Korea is a nation with, you know, thousands of years of history, the sort of, you know, the portrayal of Korean culture as backwards or somehow inadequate was, you know, it sort of helped people gravitate towards towards Kim Il-sung, who by this time had articulated the Juche ideology. So he framed the whole struggle around it. And it was in a speech in 1955, it's called On Eliminating Dogmatism and Formalism and Establishing Juche in Ideological Work. And so he's denouncing, by formalism and dogmatism, right, he means those who believe that the tactics and policies of either the USSR or China should be copied in Korea. And so he was very explicit that Juche was a way of practicing Marxism-Leninism. So in the speech, right, Marxism-Leninism is mentioned like 15 times. And the whole thing is like, we apply Marxism-Leninism to our particular circumstances, right, the actual conditions of our country. And we should work this out on our own, right? We can't mechanically apply foreign experience. So I think that these are really the sort of, you know, the factors that contribute to it, to Juche. It's, you know, it's born in the anti-colonial struggle and the Minsongdan incident and the partitioning of Korea. It's sharpened in response to the pro-Soviet and Yonan sort of attempted takeover of the party. And then it's implemented to mobilize the party in the country to forge an independent path that would secure the country from efforts of, you know, intervention by larger socialist countries who are both, you know, really important allies to the DPRK. In another speech, which is in 1965, which is when Kim Il-sung gives sort of, he says that in practical terms, right, there's three principles: independence in politics, self-sufficiency in economic development, and self-reliance in terms of defense. But he's calling it like a realistic and creative and independent interpretation of Marxism-Leninism. So it's really like, it's seen as a way of practicing Marxism-Leninism. And so it's not really positioned as like a higher stage, right? It's not like, you know, Marxism-Leninism-Maoism. It's Marxism-Leninism, Juche-ism or Kim Il-sung-ism, right? It's really, you know, a way of practicing it. And he's very clear throughout his life that this is, you know, a form of Marxism-Leninism. And although Marxism and Leninism, it gets taken out of the DPRK's constitution when they revise it in, I think, 1992, which is, of course, after the Soviet Union had dissolved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 1992. But there's still, like, reference to socialism, right? And, you know, the constitution today still contains explicit references, says that the country is organized around socialism. So even though there's been sort of different interpretations, after Kim Il-sung dies, there's become sort of codified as elevated to a, you know, the sort of uniqueness of it, I think is perhaps exaggerated a little bit. But, you know, I mean, Kim Jong-il in his life is still very explicit that it's like, that it's a sort of, you approach Marxism-Leninism through the Juche philosophy.
It's not necessarily a competing or combating ideology with Marxism-Leninism. It's more so a way to apply it. And even more specifically, one that was kind of forged through, as you just explained, decades of struggle, which is made to be applied to the Korean context and to the Korean people's struggles. So one of the things that I have heard and seen often in rooms with other communists who are speaking about the Juche ideology is that it's slightly too vague, meaning, you know, it could mean anything at all. The idea of, quote, man is the master of his destiny, self-reliance, mm-hmm. in another word, is seen as too vague to a lot of people. And most of the people who I hear saying that are white Westerners, who the concept of self-reliance is somewhat foreign to them. Is there some kind of, I guess, seeing the Juche ideology firsthand, structurally, and being in the country and watching it play out in real time, is there kind of a difference in understanding that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think so. I think that many people across the world took inspiration from Juche, from, you know, the DPRK's development, right? I mean, Che Guevara went to Pyongyang and said, this is the model, this is how we want Cuba to be, looking at what they have done. And when they built a Juche Tower in the DPRK, and when they built it, I think it was in like 82, their like delegations from all over the world, you know, Asia, Africa, Latin America, even the United States, sent plaques. Mm-hmm. Juche study groups sent plaques to be put up there, and you can see them. They're on display at the foot of the tower. And the reason why they're studying it is because they're looking for an independent path, right? An independent, right. Critical. So it's not, you know, it's not something that should be, I mean, because it's basically like articulated as a way of not being dogmatic. You know, it doesn't make sense to import it then dogmatically into another context. But you can see like just how, one, it's been successful, right? I mean, there's no way, like, I mean, if you think about how much the DPRK has been able to withstand, you know, they've overseen the defeat of Japanese imperialism. They kicked the U.S. back below the 38th parallel in 1953, forced them to sign an armistice. They survived the right-wing shift in China. They survived the demise of the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc, right? They survived the 90s and the Arduous March. And they attribute that to, you know, to Juche. And it's something that they do reference a lot. And it's almost like a, I don't know, this might seem strange, but you know when you have like an experience with like a really, you know, unique experience with someone that you can't quite like articulate 100%, but you'll like look at each other and you know exactly what you're thinking?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, it's kind of like that, where like you'll ask a question in the DPRK and then you'll just be like, oh, Juche. Right. And it's like it kind of explains it all. And so it's not like it's some supernatural thing, but it's like it's this common thread throughout the history and the politics. And it is a source of inspiration and pride. And it's, you know, what helps to sort of explain and contextualize the immense sacrifices that the people there have and continue to undertake, right, on behalf of the sort of unfinished Korean liberation struggle. So, I mean, it definitely seems odd for someone in the U.S. to sort of, you know, to sort of diss Juche and just say, oh, well, it's not, it doesn't live up to scientific standards of, you know, philosophical, you know, whatever, definitions or something like that. Like, that's just, like, who cares, you know, what you think, really?
Right. And
kind of what I say.
No, I would definitely agree with that. And I think that another portion of it is most of criticisms on the left of the Juche ideology and Juche idea are extremely Western and U.S. centric. A professor in Nigeria, Dr. Muhammad Abdullah, and he's been to the DPRK over 60 times in the last decade alone. And he is very set on keeping the Juche idea alive and well in West Africa. And in speaking with him, I learned that all throughout the decolonial struggles that were taking place across Africa, the socialist and communist groups within West Africa specifically were receiving, you know, correspondence and aid and and were very much so involved with North Korean politics, as well as receiving aid and correspondence from them. So, I mean, for example, in Burundi, Korean engineers actually traveled there to help them, you know, build certain infrastructure. In Zimbabwe, Koreans helped train soldiers to fight off colonial leaders. So, I mean, all across, you know, Africa, just for example, this connection and this reverence for the Juche idea resonates very deeply with other people who either were or still are trying to attempt to escape some kind of colonial stronghold exacerbated by the West. So yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, its quote unquote vagueness is really more so an applicability to a colonial situation or a domination situation that many people in the West simply don't get because they've never lived under those kind of structures or standards. And in speaking with Dr. Abdullah Muhammad, one of the things that he noted, and I want to get your take on this, is that in his travels to the DPRK, the presence of soldiers and military personnel is abundant, and they're everywhere on every corner, but that the relationship with them is vastly different than in almost any other country he's been to, in that they're friendly, they are actually working for the people and helping the people in their daily tasks, and they're not some separate, you know, stratified entity that's just a violent force within the country. Did you notice something similar? Can you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is true. Like, I mean, one thing is you don't see any cops. Like, I think I saw like one police car the entire time I was there, except for like traffic cops. But traffic cops are like crossing guards, right? And like what they do is they blow their whistles and they pull you over. We got pulled over like once a day. And it was astounding. Like, people, what you do when you get pulled over is you get out of the car and like you go approach this traffic guard. One of our delegation was a black man from the United States, and he was like, "Whoa, like I would never get out of my car."
Even hearing that, I'm just like, that's like a whole entire foreign concept for me as like a black person in the US.
Yeah, and you would see government cars get pulled over also and get out of the car and go talk to the crossing guard. So it wasn't like, you know, government cars were like above the law and could just do whatever they wanted to. If you were, you know, I mean, usually it's because we were going too fast or like our windshield wipers weren't on or something like that. But yeah, so you see soldiers and the only reason you can tell they're soldiers when they're walking around is because they have uniforms on. But oftentimes the uniforms are like unbuttoned because, I mean, we were there in August, so it was hot. You see them engaged in construction projects and tilling the fields because it's, you know, a really efficient way to coordinate large-scale production is through the army. And if you think about it, the DPRK isn't waging war against any countries or occupying any countries, so what else are their soldiers going to do, right, other than prepare to defend the country and then engage in production? And so that's what's happening. And you see that, you know, they move amongst the people. So when a soldier, and they're always unarmed. I don't think I saw many soldiers with arms at all. And when they're walking around, you can tell that they are the people themselves, because no one sort of cowers or moves to the other side of the street. Or, you know, like when you're walking down the street and like you pass cops, like you shut up, stop talking, you know, you just like look straight ahead or whatever. You know, that didn't happen in the DPRK with the soldiers. People were joking. We saw a woman slap a soldier in like a, they were having like a playful interaction, and this woman like hit the soldier across the face, not like hard, right? In like a, I don't know, I mean, a playful kind of manner. You know, so people are very, very comfortable with the military because they're from the people, right? I mean, it's not like there's an intense class stratification or, you know, racial stratification in the country where the soldiers are drawn from one particular racial group or one particular class, and then they're sent to repress another racial group or another class. So the dynamic is 100% different from the U.S. And they're not trying to like intimidate people. You know, they're not walking down the street like taking up as much space as possible or whatever. You know, throwing out commandments to people. They're just moving, right, and doing their thing. And people are respectful of that, and they're respectful of the people. So they very much seem to be one. And if you think about it, I mean, they don't have mandatory conscription right now. They have in the past, but you know, a lot of people have been affiliated. And we were there right in August, which is when Trump gave his fire and fury remarks and said that he would rain fire and fury down the country. And at that time, like hundreds of thousands of people went to sign up to be volunteers for the Army. And people who had been retired, you know, would sign up to re-enlist. So it's very much a, you know, it's a central institution in daily life and in the sort of government. And it was in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which devastated not just the DPRK, but also Cuba. And then there were some sort of large-scale natural disasters, droughts and and tidal waves. The Army was deployed during the arduous march. The Army was the sort of central institution that guided the country through that difficult period in terms of mobilizing production. And the power has shifted back away from the military towards the states and the sort of, you know, civilian government, and that was codified in the last party congress of the WPK in a couple of important reassignments away from the military and towards civilian posts. You know, people are proud of the, you know, the military because of you know, because it's an important sort of defense and agent in continuing to be an independent and the continuing decolonial project in Korea.
Definitely. So one of the things that is kind of happening currently at the time of recording this episode is we're seeing peace talks between the DPRK and South Korea. Now, from my understanding of speaking with various people who have been to the DPRK and speaking with actual North Koreans themselves, is that there isn't animosity between the two different Koreas. It's essentially an exacerbated situation by the U.S. And that the U.S. has been the main party driving the wedge deeper and deeper at every chance it gets. So I want to kind of talk briefly about the language used inside of North Korea when discussing South Korea, because from what I have been told, they're very aware that the South Korea is like a colonized body and is essentially, or not colonized, but an occupied body that's being occupied by the U.S. military in attack against North Korea. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no. And I mean, you know, in the DPRK, the, you know, South Korean government, it's a puppet government of the U.S. Is how they refer to it. But I would say that the main thing that framed the narrative of the North Korean people that I interacted with while I was there, which, you know, I spoke personally to hundreds of North Koreans and saw tens of thousands. So I guess that, you know, so there's no way that it's like, and I was one of five U.S. citizens there. So if this is all sort of a, you know, coordinated play to put on for the benefit of five people, like, I don't, you know, whatever. I got a bridge to sell you or whatever they say. But when we were at the DMZ, and we were looking across the border to the south. They said that's where our brothers and sisters are who aren't yet free. And they, if anything, they feel sorrow for people who have to live under U.S. occupation. So, if anything, you know, I think that's the feeling instead of animosity. Because at the border, there are U.S. troops at the border on the South Korean side. Right. And what's interesting is when we went there, they knew we were coming, and so the U.S. troops left, and so only North Korean soldiers were on the northern side of the parallel. But when we left, one of the soldiers came back and got us, and he was like, "Hey, come here." And we were still inside the building in front of the sort of houses that that are located right on the border, and we could see the U.S. troops coming back out because we had left. And so they wanted it to appear like it was just like, you know, this overblown thing. But yeah, no, as soon as we left, we saw them coming back out. And I have a picture of them from the house where they're coming back out. But yeah, no, but it's, you know, reunification. And, you know, there's always talk of like, you know, Pyongyang wants to forcefully reunify the peninsula, but that's actually not the case. And, you know, what we were told is like, no, it will take, we need a federation And before there's complete unification, we need several decades of sort of inter-Korean cooperation and a federalized system. Because there are sort of, you know, I mean, difference, it's still one nation. You know, I've been to both North and South, and, you know, it is, and it breaks my heart too, you know, the fact that I have friends in North Korea and I have friends in South Korea who, you know, can't go to the entirety of their country, even though I can, or at least, you know, until August 30th or September 1st of last year, I was able to go. And, you know, so there are sort of, you know, obviously some differences that have developed since the division of the continent. But, you know, it's still one nation, and that's their priority is reunification, but, you know, peaceful reunification. Yeah.
Well, and lastly, I guess that's a good segue into the last topic I wanted you to briefly cover is this idea of, as you just said, quote, peaceful reunification. So I know that the DPRK does not have a first strike policy, or nowhere in their constitution does it ever mention any kind of preemptive or first strike situation, mm-hmm. versus Donald Trump and the U.S. painting the country as this massive aggressor who is just inches away from pressing the nuclear button, and, you know, just mm-hmm. such a huge host of propaganda. Is it just me, or is that extremely kind of a very shallow representation that actually is false and doesn't really represent their policies, their military policies whatsoever?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, the DPRK will sort of say, you know, some bombastic things, like, but right before they say that statement, there's always an if, right? If we are attacked, we will, you know, X, Y, and Z. It's never like we will X, Y, and Z. Because, you know, obviously, like, North Korea knows, you know, they're not like, you know, they're incredibly smart. Like, if you think about the sort of skill that it takes to manage the situations, the historical life of that country, mm-hmm. There's an incredible intelligence, collective intelligence there, and it's not a collective intelligence that would think that the DPRK could beat the United States in, you know, militarily. And so, you know, that's obviously, that's the last thing that they want, right? The number one thing that they want is peace. But, you know, peace to them isn't having 30,000 U.S. troops occupying half of your country and preventing the unification and, you know, having bases all over Japan and constantly, you know, having nuclear equipped submarines patrolling the waters. So
right.
So they never threatened to preemptively strike the United States. And as someone who is a U.S. citizen and, you know, I guess I could be European, but like I'm a white guy, blonde hair, or, you know, light brown hair. You know, while I was there, it was pretty clear that I wasn't from Korea. And people there, you know, treated me with like just the utmost kindness and generosity and respect, including, you know, we met with a survivor of a you know, straight up war crime that the U.S. committed, where they took mothers and they separated them from their children. And they locked them both in these caverns and then poured gasoline in and lit them on fire. And I met someone who was, he was one of three survivors. He was like in a corner of the building. So he just passed out and he woke up several days later and left. And he was there and he was so kind to us. And there was absolutely no animosity towards the U.S. people. And that there was only a desire for normal relations between the two countries.
Again, as I said earlier, if someone's country swept mine with hundreds of thousands of pounds of tons of bombs, I would have tons of animosity. But just the fact that the Korean people, you know, throughout so much destruction and war that's been thrust upon them, from everybody I've spoken to who've been to the country, they have not lost any ounce of their humanity and are always extremely welcoming. So I think that's a good place to end right there. I want to thank you so much, Derek, for coming on. This has been a great talk. I think it'll be very educational for everybody who is listening right now. Do you want to tell people how they can find you real quick?
Sure. I'm on Twitter at Derek R. Ford. That's probably the best way.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you, Derek. Have a good day.
Thanks, Devin.